Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. At that time, to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. And now I'll turn today's meeting over to Loretta Jackson-Brown. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Candy. Good afternoon. I'm Loretta Jackson-Brown, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Division of Strategic National Stockpile at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm delighted to welcome you to today's COCA call, Experiences of CDC and Emory Healthcare in Managing Persons Under Investigation for Ebola. CDC, our planners, presenters, and their spouses, partners wish to disclose they have no financial interests or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. Planners have reviewed content to ensure there is no bias. This presentation will not include any discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or products under investigational use. PowerPoint slides are available to download for today's call. The PowerPoint slide set can be found on our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on COCA calls. The slide set is located on the March 31st call webpage under call materials. Free continuing education is offered for this COCA call. Instructions on how to earn credit will be provided at the end of the call. At the end of the presentation, you will also have the opportunity to ask the presenters questions. On the phone, dialing star 1 will put you in the queue for questions. At conclusion of today's session, the participant will be able to state the number of travelers and persons under investigation for Ebola in the U.S. from August 2014 to March 2015. Discuss the most common diagnosis for persons under investigation for Ebola. Describe the importance for appropriate evaluation of persons under investigation for Ebola in assessment hospitals, and compare and contrast different options for evaluation of persons under investigation for Ebola. Today's first presenter is Dr. Emily Cummins. Dr. Cummins is team lead for CDC's Ebola Response Domestic Clinical Inquiries team. Her team responds to inquiries and issues around persons under investigation for Ebola from clinicians, state and local health departments, and HHS. Dr. Cummins earned a doctorate of medicine and a master's in public health from Harvard University. Our second presenter is Dr. Henry Wu. Dr. Wu is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at Emory University. He is also co-director of Emory University Midtown Travel Well Center. The center implemented a protocol to evaluate persons under investigation for Ebola in the ambulatory setting. Dr. Wu is a specialist in infectious disease and internal medicine. He earned a doctorate of medicine from Harvard University Medical School. Again, the PowerPoint slides are available for download for today's call. Go to emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on COCA calls. The slide set is located on the March 31st call webpage under call materials. At this time, please welcome Dr. Cummins.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to start this slideshow. I hope those of you on the call have managed to access it. The overview of the presentation, first I'll introduce the clinical inquiries team, give a little background on the returning U.S. travelers and how they're screened, and the geographic distribution of inquiries and persons under investigation, describe some common diagnosis, and go over three case studies. And then I'll turn it over to Dr. Wu from Emory, who's going to describe the outpatient management of PUIs there, and then we'll have time for questions. The next slide shows a graph of the pyramid of travelers coming from affected countries and how many actually have had confirmed Ebola since the screening system was put into place in October. I'll start with the travelers on the bottom, which is all travelers from affected countries, and I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Nikki Cohen from the Global Migration Task Force.
Hi, thank you, Emily. So I just wanted to, on the next slide, which is titled Layered Lines of Defense Against Ebola, describe some of the safeguards that we have in place for detecting and preventing the travel of people who are potentially symptomatic with or exposed to Ebola. So starting on the right-hand side of the slide, or in the east, we have travelers leaving the affected countries, all of whom currently go through an exit screening process where they're screened for potential exposures and also symptoms. And if they do have any reported history of exposures or symptoms, they are not permitted to travel. For travel en route, we actually have a regulatory requirement for reporting of any deaths on board or illnesses that meet certain syndrome definitions to the CDC if the flight is arriving in the United States. For flights traveling to other countries, the reporting would be to the country of destination. So this is another mechanism to potentially identify ill travelers while they are traveling, even before arriving in the United States. And we also have processes where with agreements with other agencies who are trained to detect travelers and notify us if they're detected. And then, as you're aware, since October, we have been doing enhanced entry screening at five U.S. airports, where travelers on itineraries that originate in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are required to arrive. And during this entry screening process, they're again screened for potential exposures and symptoms. And if they meet the symptom criteria for a PUI, they will be referred for medical evaluation directly from the airport. And the majority of travelers are referred to health departments then for the post-arrival monitoring. On the next slide, titled U.S. Entry Screening Data, this is just a brief summary of the travelers who have been screened since October. As you can see, we have screened over 11,000 travelers, 11% of whom have been referred to CDC at the airport for additional public health assessment, either for potential exposure or symptoms. Less than 1% have been transported from the airport for medical evaluation, and none of these travelers have been detected with Ebola on entry, although one traveler was detected after entry in October while being monitored during the 21-day incubation period.
Great. Thanks, Nikki. The next slide is a going up the pyramid. We're looking at the now the travelers who are being monitored from affected countries. Of those, some develop symptoms, and some of those travelers report their symptoms, and some of those need evaluation. So we have this data from the State Coordination Task Force. The next slide shows the travelers monitored in the United States from March 16th to March 22nd. This is actually a pretty typical week. There were over 1,900 persons in active or direct active monitoring by the states. 73 of those were in the some or high-risk category at any time, and 29 states were participating in the monitoring with some or high-risk persons. 99.9% of travelers were contacted successfully and are enrolled in active or direct active monitoring, and zero people under monitoring in the U.S. have been diagnosed with Ebola since the end of October. Now, the next slide is, again, the top of the pyramid, getting to the travelers who need an evaluation and who are reported to CDC. Some of these are inquiries. They may be travelers from other countries. And of those, some are PUIs, or persons who need an investigation. We've had 272 of those since October, actually 281 now, an update. Of those, 117 have been tested for Ebola, and zero have had Ebola. Next slide is on the clinical inquiries team. The domestic clinical inquiries team here at CDC addresses inquiries about the evaluation of travelers who may be persons under investigation. We document these inquiries and the PUIs and their management. And we do a large amount of communication to HHS, other federal partners, state and local health departments. The next slide shows a map of the United States with the colors showing the colors of the state showing the number of inquiries and the number on the state showing the number of people tested. So you can see that the dark colors of Georgia and Texas, those are the states with the largest number of inquiries. Wyoming actually had no data, so that's a dark but zero. And the number on the state is the number tested. The largest number of people tested has also been from Texas, and this largely reflects what happened in October. The next slide is the distribution of inquiries and testing by epidemiologic week through March 28th, and it shows the large spike in the number of inquiries in October, weeks 40 through 46. And then since then, a pretty steady rate of inquiries through the influenza season, and the yellow, the top of the bar is in yellow, that denotes people tested. The next slide shows the top five diagnoses among PUIs that have been reported to CDC. We looked at a period of time from December 1st through March 24th, 2015, when there were 110 PUIs, and we actually have either a confirmed laboratory or a very probable diagnosis. The top diagnosis was gastroenteritis with 36 or 33%. The next most common diagnosis was an upper respiratory infection, 19 people or 17%. And then 18 people, a close third, was influenza or 16%. Malaria, there were 10 people or 9%, and the rest were unknown or other. I'm next going to go through several cases which highlight some of the issues around PUI management. Several months ago, a four-year-old arrived from Liberia, was classified as low but not zero risk, had no known Ebola exposures, and was started on active monitoring. On day 15, this child developed a fever to 101.7, had no other symptoms, and the rest of the family was well. The health department recommended an evaluation on day 16, and the child went to Hospital A. At the hospital, a fever 102 Fahrenheit was documented, and there was one moderately loose stool. A rapid test for malaria was positive for both Plasmodium falciparum and Vivax. Other laboratory tests showed a hematocrit of 19, platelets of 42,000, and a total bili of 3.5, suggesting a rather advanced malaria infection. And Hospital A was uncomfortable treating this child PUI despite an alternative diagnosis of malaria. So the child was transferred late on day 17 by EMTs in full PPE to a different hospital. And there the child received continued treatment and had slow clinical improvement, but there was a delay in malaria treatment. Ebola testing was performed more than 72 hours after the development of symptoms that was negative, highlighting the concern of Ebola even 3 days after a diagnosis has been made. Case study number two is an illustration about media. So a traveler arrived from Guinea to the United States. Monitoring was initiated by the local health department. The traveler reported a fever of 102 degrees Fahrenheit to the local health department on day five, early in the morning. The local health department called a local hospital to initiate the evaluation and then notified the state. The hospital called EMS to arrange transport, because this person did not have a means of getting to the emergency room. And then on EMS radio was heard that a possible Ebola patient was being transported. Now, EMS radio was monitored by the media, and a reporter who monitored this radio filed a press report. And then we heard about this person through the press, and HHS, as the rest of CDC and the State Health Department, were also unaware that this PUI was getting an evaluation. So we've learned that we can ask EMS not to use the radio. Case study number three is a 47-year-old who entered the U.S. from Liberia. This was a low but not zero risk traveler who was engaged in training workers and was being monitored in a rural state. The traveler developed a temperature of 101.1 and fatigue with myalgia on day 5 of monitoring. In the previous week, a family member had had fever, headache, and vomiting, and other family members also reported feeling sick with cold symptoms. There was a conference call with the state health department during which the domestic clinical inquiry team and the state agreed on the need for an evaluation, but there was some concern expressed about the hospital readiness and capacity and the possible media exposure and concern about confidentiality for this person because of the small size of the town. And also whether there was an actual need for admission for these symptoms and an evaluation. So there was an agreement to test for respiratory viruses using a rapid test for influenza as well as a PCR in the state lab. The specimen was collected while the PUI was in the car in the ER parking lot by someone in full PPE. The PUI then returned to self-isolation at home. The emergency department prescribed oseltamivir for this PUI to 6 family members, as well as prophylaxis for those who were not sick in the household but presumably had been exposed. The PUI then developed sore throat and cough that evening, which we felt was consistent with influenza, and the PUI was advised to take temperature before taking antipyretics, a very typical recommendation for us. The rapid influenza came back negative, but the PCR was positive for influenza A. So 24 hours after initiating treatment, the PUI had substantially improved, was afebrile off antipyretics. There was some residual myalgia, congestion, and cough, and the family members were also improved. The PUI returned to work 2 days later. The only wrinkle in this scenario was that the state lab PCR machine was not used for 24 to 36 hours until clinical improvement assured the team that Ebola was not the diagnosis. But the stoppage did necessitate sending some specimens for testing to other labs. So the take-home points from our case studies is that appropriate care should be provided in a timely manner for PUIs, and the designation of someone as a PUI shouldn't delay care. Media notification can often be managed, and we at CDC are very happy to help with that. And then I think I'm going to transition now to Henry Wu in considering how and when an outpatient management of PUIs may be advantageous. Go ahead, Dr. Wu.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Koomans, for the invitation to share experiences evaluating PUI at the Emory Travel Well Center. In case you don't know, Travel Well is Emory's travel clinic, and early on after the Ebola epidemic progressed, it became clear to us that we would potentially need to evaluate potentially a large number of returned travelers from affected countries with ill symptoms. And to address this need, we developed a procedure to see patients in the outpatient setting. And on my first slide, I asked why even consider ambulatory evaluation of PUI. And what we were thinking is that probably, and I think some of the data just presented would support, that most PUI are at low risk for actually Ebola infection, both the low epidemiologic risk, low but not zero epidemiologic risk category, and also just based on a clinical assessment. And for the vast majority of these patients, an emergency department or inpatient care may not be necessary, particularly given that most common travel-related infections do not require this level of care. We were also thinking about the potential burden on our colleagues in the emergency department and inpatient resources, as well as our colleagues at our Ebola treatment unit. So it became clear that developing a way to evaluate some of these patients as an outpatient would be important. Finally, seeing patients who are at low risk in the outpatient setting potentially also can minimize patient stress and exposure to hospitalization risks and possibly minimize public visibility. On the next slide, I have listed the key parts of a PUI clinic visit. And I do want to emphasize at this point that, as you know, I'm going to cover the process we went through to develop a protocol and some of the details and lessons we have learned. And even if folks out there may not be considering an outpatient evaluation unit, I hope some of our lessons may still be helpful if, you know, if you are considering your protocols for your emergency departments and other settings. So essentially, we started by deconstructing a clinic visit and looked at each step, considering how each could be conducted with attention to infection control, patient care, and privacy. And these steps are first, triage and scheduling, second, arrival to clinic, third, the exam room itself, four, the POI care team, next, the clinical approach we took, laboratory testing issues, disposition and follow-up, and finally, waste management and environmental cleaning. And I'll go over each one of these steps in more detail. First step, of course, is determining if the POI is appropriate to be seen in the outpatient setting. We are referred POI from other parts of Emory Healthcare or potentially directly from public health authorities. When we hear about a patient, we immediately consider if they meet our criteria for outpatient evaluation versus triage to the emergency department or potentially to our colleagues at Emory's Ebola Treatment Unit. And we refer to it as the Serious Communicable Diseases Unit, or SCDU in short. The first criteria is that there really should be a low suspicion for Ebola, and that most likely we probably would not even pursue Ebola testing on this patient. And this is for a couple reasons. Obviously, a patient with confirmed or highly likely Ebola infection are better management and better managed in the Ebola treatment unit. On a practical level, we also had to consider that Ebola testing, even at Emory, can have a turnaround time of several hours, so keeping somebody in clinic for an extended period would not be ideal. Secondly, another criteria is that there really must be no significant wet symptoms, that is, nausea, vomiting, or bleeding, or profuse diarrhea. And this is primarily an infection control concern, and patients with these symptoms are generally triaged to the emergency department setting. Also, there, of course, must be no medical indication for emergency department or hospitalization. Of course, if the POI sounds like they will need IV fluids or are medically unstable, then certainly we will triage them elsewhere. And finally, a practical time consideration. Our clinic has standard clinic hours, so if we do hear about a POI during the weekend when our clinic will be closed for some time, we will then triage them to the emergency department, so an evaluation will not be delayed. On the next slide, once we schedule a patient, our team notifies a key list of internal and external stakeholders and collaborators, including the public health authorities, infection control, our laboratory, our SCDU team, our security staff, environmental services, and even our neighboring clinics that are next door to us. And that was one of the lessons learned as we implemented our procedure. It's important to let the folks who may see our team know what's going on, and so they can explain potentially to other patients what they may have seen. Next slide is our arrival to our clinic procedure. We designed this procedure with the goals of minimizing POI exposure to other patients, staff, as well as minimize visibility as much as possible. To this end, we instruct the patient to arrive at a backdoor entrance, basically an old ambulance entrance where they can leave their car and avoid the need to use the patient lot and the usual elevators and lobby entrances. We meet them there with an arrival team. This is made up of the Travelwell clinic physician, a nurse, and a security escort in PPE. We give the patient, the POI, a surgical mask and transport them via wheelchair. The security escort plays a key role. First, they secure the route through the hospital and the service elevator. Secondly, they are instructed not to come in contact with the POI and maintain a distance, and therefore they remain clean and are able to carry our clean supplies, which we do bring with us. We do bring down an MSS bag, towels, extra gloves, and we keep these on hand just in case there is an unexpected episode of MSS or other event during transport. On the next slide, I describe our exam room, and when we get to our clinic, basically the physician and nurse enter the exam room with the patient. The room is actually a standard clinic room, but we have prepared it to minimize the surface area that will need to be decontaminated. So all unnecessary decorations, furniture, and equipment have been removed. We also prepare the room by placing all the equipment that the team will likely need ready in the room, mostly disposable equipment such as disposable stethoscopes, pen lights, other exam equipment, as well as phlebotomy materials, specimen swabs, et cetera. Some equipment that might be needed but not necessarily is kept outside the room. This includes a bedside commode or a urinal in case the patient needs to use the bathroom. On the next slide, I describe the team, our POI evaluation team, the roles and the various training. There are basically four core members, each with a unique role. I've already mentioned the physician, who is the team lead and evaluates the patients and reports to the public health authorities. The nurse, in addition to transporting the patient, measures the vital signs and collects blood specimens in the exam room. And this is, of course, since we are unable to use our regular outpatient laboratory for our phlebotomy. We have a third team member we call the buddy, and this is a team member who is stationed outside the room in PPE and is watching the POI and the evaluation team inside the room. And the buddy's role is to monitor the situation, look for PPE breaches, and as well as monitor the room exiting procedure and PPE doffing process. The buddy also helps with handing over needed equipment when needed in the room. And finally, the last member of our team, since the buddy cannot leave the doorway, we have a fourth team member that serves as, we call him the runner, to transport specimens, help with communications, and do any other errands as needed. And so the first three members of our team, the physician, nurse, and buddy, are trained in PPE, both in the donning and doffing procedures. On our next slide, I describe our clinical approach to the POIs. And the approach we use is a little different from the usual sick traveler we typically performed. Of course, we do a thorough history and exam, including asking about exposures, travel dates, malaria, prophylaxis, adherence, vaccination history, and sick exposures, both within the country in the Ebola-affected country as well as back here in the U.S. And we do. For testing, we do fairly aggressive routine lab testing and potentially much more than we typically do in a non-POI patient. As for Ebola testing, however, we consider it. However, this is not routine. Again, any patient who is highly likely to have Ebola or we have significant concern about that would be likely triaged elsewhere. Therefore, the goal is that the patients we see in the clinic are unlikely to need or to have Ebola testing as indicated. Finally, we strongly consider empiric treatment, such as oseltamivir for influenza or possibly antibiotics if we suspect a bacterial infection or possibly even empiric antimalarials. And the key goal really is to not miss dangerous treatable infections while confirming an alternative diagnosis if possible. Though, of course, we always keep in mind that an alternative diagnosis does not rule out Ebola. We are aggressive in our treatments because we try to treat the likely cause of illness to facilitate recovery, and then we consider a patient that recovers, as would be expected for an alternative diagnosis, be essentially ruled out. On the next slide, I go into more detail about our lab testing. Our routine panel of labs for the febrile PUI includes a CBC with differential, a complete metabolic panel, a malaria rapid diagnostic test and smears, as well as two sets of blood cultures. We consider other tests according to symptoms. In somebody with respiratory symptoms, we may do a nasopharyngeal swab for rapid influenza PCR and viral respiratory panel. We may do throat swabs for strep. We may consider urine studies if they have urinary symptoms. And this is all collected in the room. We label and package the specimen in the room. And again, in the usual setting where we do not strongly suspect Ebola and are not pursuing Ebola testing, we then actually have the specimens transported to our routine hospital lab where the testing is performed. On the other hand, if we were to pursue Ebola testing, we do have a separate procedure where the specimens, all specimens, are specially packaged and transported under special precautions to our Serious Communicable Diseases Unit laboratory for Ebola testing, as well as routine tests to be done there. On their next slide, we describe our disposition and follow-up procedure. If we do not suspect Ebola and the POI is clinically stable, we will discharge them home to self-isolation. We might sometimes wait for initial stat lab test results, such as the CBC, CMP, the metabolic panel, and the malaria rapid diagnostic test, to provide supporting evidence that there is no indication for immediate hospitalization. Of course, we always review our disposition plan with the public health authority before proceeding and make sure we're all in agreement. We give the POI a 24/7 contact information for our clinic physician, and after discharge, we follow them very closely. We typically call them that evening and also the next day to reassess them and confirm that they are appear to be recovering, as would be expected for whatever alternative diagnosis we suspect. Anyone who worsens or has persistent symptoms is brought back for more evaluation and potentially Ebola testing. And should we bring them back, we again reassess them and determine whether or not they are best seen in our clinic versus another setting like the emergency department. Next slide, a few notes just on waste management and environmental cleaning. When we do discharge a POI, if we are not suspecting Ebola, our environmental services team conducts a terminal cleaning of the room. All disposable equipment is disposed of in the biohazard waste chain. Alternatively, in the situation where we have a higher suspicion of Ebola and we are, you know, for example, pursuing Ebola testing, potentially we would have cleaning done by our a special team from our Serious Communicable Diseases Unit. My last slide here, really just to emphasize that advanced planning is critical. You know, the coming up with this procedure took a long process. We had to engage all the various stakeholders in the planning, and support from our institution was key. Practice was critical, including many drills, tabletop exercises, and finally, each time after we've implemented this procedure, we've reviewed how things went and looked for ways to improve the process. And that's the last of what I'm covering. Thanks for your attention. I'll turn it over to Loretta for the question.
Thank you, presenters, for providing our COCA audience with such a wealth of information. We will now open up the lines for the question and answer session. Questions are limited to clinicians who would like information on PUI for Ebola. For those who have media questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at 404-639-3286 or send an email to media@cdc.gov. Operator?
Thank you. At this time, to ask a question, press star 1, please. Please unmute your line and record your name to be introduced. Again, for all questions, press star 1. If you'd like to withdraw the request at any time, you may press star 2. Thank you. One moment, please, for your first question.
And while we're waiting for the first questions, just a point of discussion to our presenters. Why isn't Ebola testing done on everyone?
Okay, it's Dr. Wu here, and it's a very good question, and it's as much a practical as well as a clinical decision. As I mentioned, even in our institution, the turnaround time for Ebola testing can be extended. Obviously, it does take a lot of resources to perform, so given the number of POI that we were anticipating to see, it didn't seem practical to pursue Ebola testing on everybody. Furthermore, again, in the outpatient setting at least, we are typically seeing folks very early in the course of their illness when the testing itself may not even be very sensitive. So given the low suspicion as well as the practical issues, it seems that routine testing would not have been practical or even medically necessary.
Thank you, Dr. Wu. Operator, do we have our first question?
Yes, we do. As a reminder for others, again, for questions, press star 1. Our first question is Dr. Wasi Fasad. Your line is open.
Dr. Wasi Fasad, Mercy College. I'm concerned about the accuracy of diagnostic testing, especially rapid diagnostic testing. What has been your experience regarding false negatives and false positives? I guess in this case, particularly false positives.
Are you referring specifically to Ebola testing or other diagnostics?
Ebola test, yes.
It is well known that the PCR test for Ebola, even if it is a PCR test in the first 72 hours, may not necessarily pick up Ebola for someone who does have Ebola. In West Africa, for example, where the prior probability of someone having Ebola is higher and their exposures are probably more than the typical traveler who comes back to the United States, the testing may get done early, but if someone has symptoms consistent with Ebola in that setting, they are often isolated and then the testing is repeated. In the United States, as Dr. Wu suggests, it's a clinical judgment as to whether or not Ebola testing is even needed. And our experience in the clinical inquiries team at CDC is that many PUIs do not need Ebola testing and often will be improved after 72 hours, at which point Ebola testing certainly isn't clinically indicated if someone has been afebrile and has no more symptoms. Does that address your question?
I was wondering at a more granular level, have you had PUIs who, upon screening, rapid diagnostic testing, screened positive, but that wasn't confirmed?
No, we've not had any positive screens for Ebola.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Warner Hudson, your line is open.
Hi, this is Dr. Warner Hudson from UCLA Health System, Reagan Hospital, where we've done a number of rule-outs. Can you talk about the experience of, as clinicians caring for persons under suspicion and being a member of the Ebola team, the experience of the monitoring, the logging, how that whole process went for you as clinicians?
Are you referring to monitoring after we see them a PUI in the clinic, or are you talking about just the active monitoring after travel?
Well, I'm talking about the people who are really caring for Ebola patients. So the monitoring would start once you realize you have an Ebola patient and would continue until the end of the incubation period.
Oh, so the health, you're talking about the healthcare workers?
Correct.
Who would need to monitor themselves.
The healthcare workers.
Because they were part of the healthcare team?
Correct, who are being monitored.
Right, so those, they would be part of the routine monitoring in the state, and they would be entered into the state monitoring system. Right, we haven't had that recently. I think Nebraska and NIH have had some recently.
Just trying to get a sense of how that went for the clinicians involved.
Do you have any experience of how that went at Emory?
No, I don't have any information on that. But I think just as Dr. Koomans mentioned, they are subject to the same guidelines and policies as anyone who's traveled and has similar exposures.
Right, so I think that's the temperature twice a day and reporting. I think that's the extent of it.
Right, I mean, it's a lot of people, and you've got people in the hospital monitoring, you've got health departments monitoring. Just wondering how it goes. I've heard differing reports from Emory, Bellevue, Nebraska. Anyway, we'll hold that for another session, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, for questions from the phone, press star 1, please. Our next question comes from Anita Berry. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm calling from the Boston Public Health Commission, and I'm trying to clarify if precautions used by your laboratory for testing specimens for a PUI vary depending on the clinician's diagnosis.
Hi. I assume you're referring specifically to our Emory Health System laboratory. That's a very good question. What I was describing is really a two-tiered approach for PUIs. If in the setting where we are suspicious enough about Ebola, where we are going to pursue Ebola testing, then the lab testing is performed in the laboratory that is within the serious communicable diseases unit. So That is our special, Ebola treatment unit. For the POI that we determine after our clinical assessment that are unlikely to have Ebola, our lab actually tests them. Our routine hospital lab does do the testing for the routine testing, our CBC, blood cultures, et cetera. So, they use the standard precautions that would be recommended for clinical laboratories.
Thank you. That's been a huge issue in some of our healthcare facilities in Boston.
Oh, and I certainly I would say we got to this point. It was not certainly a decision that was just made off the bat. This was just something that with a lot of discussion and review of recommendations and guidelines that we came to. We've been comfortable with that.
Thank you.
Thank you again. For any questions, press star 1, please, and please record your name. Again, press star 1.
Operator, do we have any more questions in the queue?
It looks like we do have one in queue. Stand by, please. All right, thank you. We have a question from Stephen Bach. Your line is open.
Thank you very much for the great webinar. I have a quick question about your clinic setting. I like your setup with that safety person in the doorway to be the assistant to make sure the donning, and particularly the doffing of PPE, is done safely and appropriately. What happens when your clinic has a door that is solid? You can't see through it. Do you stand there with the door?
Good question. Actually, that is our clinic. The door is open.
You do leave it open.
And it's and this buddy system really is a direct we directly adopted from the protocols from our Ebola treatment unit at Emory, where they very adhere to the system very strictly of constantly monitoring each other. Yes, we have a standard clinic door. It's closed, so it is open, and it does require us to secure that whole hallway for privacy issues and various reasons. So I'll be the first to admit that seeing a PUI in our clinic is no small deal. This is not a 40-minute visit and, with patients before and after. We do a lot of juggling of our schedules. It takes up at least 4, if not more, of our staff time, of several hours. So it is very resource-intensive on our end. But I think in the bigger picture, it actually saves in other ways.
Sure. Our concern is that the patient shows up to the clinic visit for other purposes and then says, and by the way, I also have these symptoms. And so the triage starts at the front desk. And then we have to put this person in an exam room and kind of close off a portion of the clinic to then respond to this. But it wasn't that they planned to come to our clinic as a PUI. They become a PUI upon arrival.
Yes. We do. I didn't go into detail into Emory's screening process, but that is always a concern. At the moment, any patient making an appointment at Emory is actually on the phone asked if they've traveled and have symptoms.
Right.
So the hope is that we catch them even before they make an appointment. But
excellent.
Should somebody unexpectedly arrive as a walk-in or did not offer these this history or symptoms in advance, our front desks of all of our clinics are instructed to perform essentially what you just mentioned, to immediately isolate the patient. And then at that point, they would contact our infection control department, and then at that point, arrangements would be made to have that patient be transported appropriately.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much.
Cool.
Thank you. Next question is Suzanne Sestouli. Your line is open.
Hi. I missed part of the phone call, and I wanted to know, what do you do with all of the patient care equipment once the patient has been gone through the whole regime of being an Ebola or patient under investigation? Do you destroy everything or what?
We try as much as possible to use disposable equipment. That includes the disposable isolation stethoscope. We use a disposable BP cuff, a battery-operated thermometer, et cetera. The equipment are not as easy to dispose are cleaned, terminally cleaned, and wiped down appropriately. But the idea is to maximize the amount of disposable equipment. The room is stripped down of excess furniture, decorations, everything that, to really minimize the amount of surface area that would be need to be cleaned.
Okay, thank you. The reason I'm asking is because we have a designated area and for a patient, should we get one, and we were going to set up like a lab next door, but the lab manager is wanting to use that piece of equipment because it's just basically sitting in the basement now. And so she was thinking that we could take this small lab equipment and put it in the room and have the nurses do the tests, and I'm not thinking that's a good idea.
I would agree that any less complicated surfaces to clean is going to be make things much easier. And we try as much as possible to triage patients PY who might have wet symptoms not to come to clinic, but our concern always is if somebody develops wet symptoms, does have vomiting and et cetera during the visit, we have to be prepared to handle that situation.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Tammy Chandler. Your line is open.
Yes, I was just wondering, how do you treat staff that have either taken care of the Ebola patients or a person under investigation after they've taken care of these people during their 21-day monitoring? Are they mixed back into staffing and patient care duties, or are they off work for the monitoring time?
There's no restriction, work restriction during the monitoring period.
Operator, are you there?
Yes. Was she finished with the question?
Yes, that's all I needed.
Thank you. Next question, Russell Eggert. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. I was going to get back to the question previously about rapid testing. So there was the FDA issued an emergency use authorization for an Ebola rapid test. I think it was about a month or so ago. I take it that they're not utilizing the test in Emory. Are you aware of anybody in the U.S. using the test, or if there are plans to use it as a screening diagnostics tool, or do you think it's probably just better to rely on the typical molecular test?
Thank you for the question. I believe Emory does have the BioFire test. BioFire is actually a platform that's used for multiple pathogens. Is very useful for screening, but for the EUA for Ebola, what we understand is that the BioFire may be used for Ebola in conjunction with the PCR test, so that they should be run concordantly. So you would you might have one test result earlier than the other, but they would both be run. And in a sense, the PCR test is being done to sort of quality control and make sure that the BioFire result isn't used appropriately.
Okay, I was actually referring to I'm not sure how this is pronounced, the re-EBOV antigen rapid test, which apparently can give you a result in 15 to 20 minutes.
I don't know if we have recent experience with that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And as a reminder for questions, press star 1. Our next question is Genevieve. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for that great presentation. My name is Dr. Buster. I'm with the Oregon Health Authority. I had a question about your interactions with the local health departments and perhaps how you coordinate with them if one of the persons under monitoring becomes symptomatic, and have you built up a relationship, just curious around that, for the controlled evaluation of pumps who become symptomatic. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So the domestic clinical inquiries team takes calls and gets email questions from state and local health departments and public health authorities. The phone number for anyone who wants to call is 770-488-7100. And the team is here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's always someone who can be reached and who is able to not only take the information but also collect a team here at CDC who is able to help address any questions or provide sort of guidance in management. So we try to, sometimes we need a conference call to do that. Sometimes we can provide answers if it's a short question. But generally we try to help the health departments in navigating the variety of issues that come up for PUIs in their management, whether that's the duration of the hospital stay or there might be some media questions, alternative diagnosis testing. There are also experts here at CDC to address those issues. So we're always happy to help and really just to try to provide guidance and support for the decisions that folks there in the hospital and then the health departments need to make. Does that
help? Thank you. I was also wondering if Dr. Wu, if that clinic has become, if that are coordinated with the local health department so that no pums in the area who become symptomatic or if they're being using the Emory clinic, then that great setup that's been put together there to assist with evaluating pums who aren't, don't have any wet system symptoms and aren't sick enough to go to the ED.
I work closely with the health departments, they certainly know how to reach us. I wouldn't necessarily say there are various points of contact at Emory. Obviously, we have our colleagues in our Ebola treatment unit and infection control, and really we all work together when we hear about something. So, so in short, when we are notified of a patient, we collaborate with each other and we have developed ties with the health departments.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Eva Palmer. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you. My question is for Dr. Wu regarding some of the information that was presented on the ambulatory side. And we've been on the rare occasion working collaboratively with our local public health department. So it hasn't been something that is something that we think will probably happen, but what our one question is we are a hospital with many ambulatory sites, so we've built in workflows for the ambulatory sites in case they were to have a walk-in patient. So the one thing that we've not been able to really identify clearly is if they walk in, we're wondering what your experience were with this, if they walked in and they were screened at check-in to be a person of concern, not necessarily a PUI at that level. They were, put into an isolation, a designated room. At what point, if they're dry, we've actually had some pushback by staff, if they're a dry patient, where do you go into advanced PPE? I mean, if they were to happen to come to your Emory ambulatory area and they were a dry patient, made it that far, would you, prior to really establishing them being PUI, do anything more than standard precautions or minimal PPE? That's really my question.
So you're talking about not necessarily folks who present to our clinics, but other ambulatory sites?
Potentially someone who would make it through, who gets screened at check-in to be a positive traveler, maybe with a fever, so they get put back into a room, and then staff need to go in and do additional questioning. So our ambulatory sites, our convenient care specifically, they have wanted to put on full PPE, so enhanced PPE, PAPRs, everything, even though the patient is not wet. I was just wondering, have you, in your processes there, would you have someone do an assessment for PUI status prior to donning full PPE? that make
sense?
That's
a very good question, and I think you're correct. I think just because somebody has triggered the flag and is correctly isolated does not necessarily mean that staff need to come in full PPE. And obviously, there are practical issues if we're talking about multiple ambulatory sites. And as you, I'm sure, already aware, PPE involves not a lot of expense and training to properly use. So it's not
yes.
as simple as sending PPE kits to all the ambulatory sites. But the most important thing is keeping distance, obviously, as the patient is assessed. In the way our procedure would work, our clinic would immediately notify our infection control department to further evaluate the patient to determine if potentially there's PUI criteria are met. And since you brought up the PPE question, I will say that in our ambulatory setup at Travelwell, we use the lower level PPE, not the PAPRs, on a routine, not by any means. Again, this is the gowns, double gloves, face shields, head bonnet, shoe coverings, etc. But we are not using PAPRs, or our exam room is not negative pressure. I should probably make that clear.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Right. Right. We're pretty confident in the public health system alerting us to folks in the area, but if just one came through, we have kind of a pushback with staff wanting to come out to a waiting area to gather someone in full bioterrorism gear. That doesn't seem practical. There seems to be but I like the idea of the distance. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and we've always gotten all kinds of feedback like that from our staff, and it's important to consider that. I'd like to emphasize to my own staff that anyone who presents in our clinic setting and who just happens to walk in is likely going to be somebody with mild illness and presenting early in the illness course. And so even in that really, really small chance that it is a true case that somehow just appears suddenly, it probably is extremely low risk. I mean, we still, precautions should be made, but again, I think just explaining that and goes a long ways in allaying staff concerns. The way our staff has gotten very used to it, as well as our neighboring clinics who don't directly participate, but they know we are just being extra careful just in case, and if anything, they are more comfortable with that fact because. We are all aware that there are many folks traveling, coming back and forth, and the fact that we are very careful, we catch things early, and if anything, we are taking plenty of precautions. I think that really reassures our staff.
Very good. Thank you.
On behalf of COCA, I would like to thank everyone for joining us today with a special thank you to our presenters, Dr. Koumans and Dr. Wu. If you are a member of the Guinean diaspora in the U.S. and are a medical professional with clinical, public health, or epidemiology experience, and you would like to volunteer as a healthcare worker, there are a number of organizations providing those services in regions of Africa where the Ebola epidemic is occurring. For example, Doctors Without Borders or USAID. If you do volunteer as a healthcare worker, ensure to stay up to date on treatment information through COCA. If you would like to provide logistical, material, or financial support, you can do so through donations to organizations such as the CDC Foundation, Doctors Without Borders, UNICEF, or the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, among others. Information about non-federal organizations are provided as a service to our audience and are not an endorsement of these organizations or their programs by CDC or the federal government. CDC is not responsible for the content of the individual's organization website. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next few days. Free continuing education is available for this call. Those who participated in today's COCA conference call and would like to receive continuing education should complete the online evaluation by April 30th using course code WC2286. If you will listen to this call on demand, you will need to complete the online evaluation between May 1, 2015 and March 31, 2016. Use course code WD2286. All continuing education credits and contact hours for COCA conference calls are issued online through TCE Online, the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System at www.cdc.gov/TCE Online. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls, please subscribe to COCA by sending us an email to coca@cdc.gov. Write subscribe in the subject line. Also, CDC launched a Facebook page for our health partners. Like our page at facebook.com/CDC Health Partners Outreach to receive COCA updates. Thank you again for being a part of today's COCA call. Have a great day.
Thank you for your participation. That does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.